from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network. This is EWTN News Nightly.
The sixth day of mourning in the city of Rome is Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, prefect of the Dicastery of the Doctrine of Faith, celebrates Mass in St. Peter's for the repose of the soul of Pope Francis. Good evening, and thank you for joining us. I'm Tara Mergener. As the Church celebrates the feast day of St. Joseph the Worker, Cardinal Fernandez remembers Pope Francis as a man who always saw the dignity of work.
Because for Pope Francis, work expresses and nourishes the dignity of the human person. It permits him to develop his capacities. It helps him to grow relationships, helps him to feel himself to be a collaborator of God by taking care in improving this world.
And today we are within 1 week at the start of the conclave. The cardinals did not meet today, as they usually do, because it's Labor Day in Italy. But preparations are still underway as the Church moves closer to the election of her next Holy Father. Joining us now from Rome is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President of EWTN News. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Bunsen. We are just 6 days away now from the start of the conclave, and though the world will be watching, it's a very secretive affair. In fact, the apostolic constitution that set the rules for the conclave says there must be no violation of secrecy. So how is that maintained?
Well, they take the secrecy of the proceedings very, very seriously, and they do it in two different ways. The first is very practically. The Sistine Chapel, the Casa Santa Marta, will be swept for possible bugs, for listening devices. You can imagine there are a lot of countries all over the world that have a keen interest in what the cardinals are talking about and certainly how they're reaching their decisions. So that type of security is in place. And, of course, the cardinals themselves have to surrender all of their own electronic devices. So there are no phones or anything like that in the conclave either. And then there's the more personal side. Each cardinal at the start of the conclave takes an oath of secrecy. The reason for that is to maintain the security of their deliberations so that they know that they can speak freely. And so this oath is considered very important to the point, in fact, where if you violate it and those who participate in the conclave or help it who take the same oath, you could be subject to excommunication.
Wow. Serious business for sure. So a lot of people are also wondering, what will it be like behind the Vatican walls? Will the cardinals have any downtime, for example?
Well, for the cardinals, the schedule is fairly regular. They're going to have Mass, especially once the voting starts. They have Mass. So they're staying at the Casa Santa Marta, or the Vatican guest house, or technically it's called the Domus Santa Marta in Latin. So they're going to be going from basically two places, the Casa Santa Marta, where they're living sort of in seclusion, to the Sistine Chapel every day. Now, they have time for lunch, and then in the evenings, after the second vote is taken of the day, they are free to spend their time. And much of it is spent in prayer, you know, contrary to what movies sometimes try to show or claim. The cardinals actually pray together a great deal of their time. But then in the evenings especially, they have a chance to talk to each other, to get to know each other, and to continue that assessment of who they really do think should be the next pope.
So interesting. Well, let's move on to the election itself. How will the cardinals cast their votes?
Yes, well, the cardinals, in a ceremony that dates back many, many centuries, and in fact, the basic rules that govern the conclave date back all the way to 1274, when the conclave system was introduced. That itself is a very long and colorful history. But each morning twice, and each afternoon twice, until they actually elect a pope, they will do votes. And lots are drawn. You'll have scrutineers, you'll have revisers. So a very thorough system of checking each vote is taken. Each cardinal writes the name of the person he thinks should be pope, places it into a very large, sometimes a chalice, sometimes a receptacle, and then that itself is emptied as vote after vote is tallied. And each vote after it's done is pierced with a needle and thread, and they're all tied together so that there's no possible accident. It sounds very old school. Well, it's old school, but it also really works.
Well, lastly, as you know, much of Rome is closed today because it's May 1st and Italy's Labor Day, but it's also the Feast of St. Joseph the Worker. So what's it about that the 2 days coincide? What can you tell us?
Well, they coincide partly because Pope Pius XII, back in the 1950s, wanted to do two things. He wanted to honor St. Joseph in another way. And we honor St. Joseph, of course, as one of the great patron saints of workers. He holds a lot of titles, of course. He's the patron of the Universal Church. He's the terror of demons. But this day is dedicated to him as a master craftsman, as a carpenter, but also as a hardworking person. And Pius was very much aware of the threat of communism and other atheistic tendencies. And a lot of them celebrated, of course, May Day, which is one of the international days for communists. And to sort of offset that, he dedicated this day to St. Joseph the Worker. And as Pope Francis always said, if you want to solve a problem, go to St. Joseph. And so here today, we honor St. Joseph and we honor all workers.
Wow, so much insight, so much knowledge. Dr. Bunsen, thank you so much for keeping us informed of what's going on over there. So interesting and amazing times.
Great to be with you, and let's keep praying for our cardinals.
Absolutely. Well, as the conclave approaches, more cardinals are speaking out. In an interview with EWTN, German Cardinal Gerhard Müller shared his thoughts on some character traits he thinks the next pope should have.
Yes, personal character traits are important as well. Of course, there's no such thing as a perfect person, nor some kind of Superman. Those have only ever brought us trouble. What's needed is a human being like you and me. But I believe it's important that, in terms of character, the person has a sense of balance. Neither authoritarian and self-satisfied on one side, nor a perpetually indecisive person who stumbles over his own feet or lacks the courage to act.
Getraut, also natürlich auch menschliche Eigenschaften.
And we are nearing the end of the 9-day mourning period for Pope Francis. Tonight, we remember the late Holy Father through the eyes of someone who knew him better than most, his own nephew. EWTN Vatican correspondent Colin Flynn had the opportunity to sit down with Jose Ignacio Bergoglio, who offers a rare and personal glimpse into the life and legacy of Pope Francis.
As the evening sun sets over Buenos Aires, in one of the city's suburbs, children play on a beautiful carousel. The mechanical music organ at the heart of these old carousels was once used to practice tango dancing to in years gone by, a music and a dance that a young Bergoglio had a great love for. And in a coffee shop overlooking the square, I'm meeting Jose Ignacio Bergoglio, Pope Francis's nephew, who remembers his sense of humor. Jose, I know you have a very fond memory of your uncle Bergoglio from your confirmation. What happened?
Well, I was so fortunate that my uncle gave me my first communion and confirmation. And during the confirmation, there was a tradition that the archbishop would give each person a gentle and loving slap on the cheek. I stood in line with my classmates, but when it was my turn, he saw me. Jorge gave me a much harder blow. Then he winked at me and he smiled. That's one of the things that I admired most about him, that he was able to turn a serious moment into something fun.
Jose grew up without a father, and so would often turn to his uncle for guidance.
I remember that he was a great counselor for me. You see, I grew up without a father. And so he was one of the figures I looked to as a father figure, someone who could advise you, who challenges you, who accompanies you. That was Jorge. He and my Uncle Albert were the two most important men in my family. And he would also correct me when I made mistakes.
For the Bergoglio family, that ethos of looking after and encouraging each other is, Jose says, what also helped Jorge Mario Bergoglio deepen his faith and discover his vocation for the priesthood after being supported by his grandmother.
Without a doubt, it was his grandmother Rosa who was such a great influence on his religious vocation and his journey to the priesthood. She was the one who taught him about reading religious books and the one who supported him the most with his decision to love God and also all of mankind.
And And when, in 2013, white smoke emerged from that chimney at the Vatican, José Ignatius Bergoglio watched live on TV in amazement as he heard his uncle's name being called out, and then the name Pope Francis.
I began to shake. I never expected that Jorge would be elected as a pope. I was standing there right in front of the television in shock. Then all of a sudden, the phone started ringing and ringing. But all we wanted was for the world to be quiet for a moment so we could comprehend what was happening. I realized then that Uncle Jorge was no longer just ours. He was now going to be everybody's Jorge.
In Buenos Aires, Argentina, Colm Flynn for EWTN News Nightly.
What a memory indeed. Well, filmmaker Martin Scorsese is producing a feature-length documentary about Pope Francis. The film Aldeus, A New Story will feature conversations with the late pontiff in what is believed to be his final in-depth on-camera interview. The documentary will highlight the work of Scholas Occurrentes, the educational movement Pope Francis founded. A release date has not yet been announced. Well, we have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. A surprise move in the Trump administration. The president removing his national security advisor only to nominate him to another office. Where he's going and who's taking his place. And the world's oldest nun has passed away. But there was one thing she was credited for, her longevity, and it's something we all share. In its first-of-a-kind ruling, a judge barred the Trump administration from deporting Venezuelans from South Texas under an 18th-century wartime law. U.S. District Court Judge Fernando Rodriguez Jr. ruled the president's use of the Alien Enemies Act was, quote, unlawful. His decision means Trump cannot rely on the law to detain or deport any alleged members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua within his district. The president nominated Rodriguez to serve in 2017. And President Trump did not answer questions about his national security team at the end of an event marking the National Day of Prayer, but he later revealed his plans on Truth Social. Secretary of State Marco Rubio now has even more responsibilities, while two prominent Catholics join a commission on religious liberty. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Tara, here at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, it was a day to focus on prayer, but then suddenly, a big staff shakeup.
Michael Waltz loses his job as national security advisor just weeks after he added a journalist to a Signal chat used to discuss military attacks against the Houthis in Yemen. Instead, President Donald Trump says he's nominating Waltz to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Trump writes, "Mike Waltz has worked hard to put our nation's interests first. I know he will do the same in his new role." In the interim, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will serve as National Security Advisor while continuing his strong leadership at the State Department. Democratic lawmakers were quick to respond.
It's not surprising, based on the kind of original Signalgate thing. I think most of us view this as the first, but not necessarily the last.
I didn't have any like strong feelings on that, but he probably is not going to use Signal anymore.
President Trump did not address the Waltz departure during an hour-long event in the Rose Garden.
As we defend religious freedom in America, we're also standing up against religious persecution around the world.
The event brought together a variety of faith leaders to recognize the National Day of Prayer. President Trump asked God to guide our steps and build up our beloved nation to even greater heights.
So as we bow our heads in this beautiful day, once again we have to trust our God, because our God knows exactly where we're going, what we're doing, knows every inch of our life.
The president then signed an executive order creating a new Religious Liberty Commission. Among those serving in the group, Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York and Bishop Robert Barron of Winona, Rochester, Minnesota, known for his evangelization through his nonprofit Word on Fire. He thanked the president for the formation of the commission,
which I think is of extraordinary significance for our country. And thank you to so many of the top leaders of our country who are here. would show the priority you give to this very important theme.
And then the bishop, with fellow faith leaders on the dais in the sun-drenched rose garden, prayed.
Heavenly Father, Sovereign King, we bless you, we praise you, and we thank you for all your benefits to our country. We know that the rights we enjoy to life, to liberty, to the pursuit of happiness, are given not by government or popular consensus, but by you.
Tonight, President Trump delivers the commencement address to graduates at the University of Alabama and then travels to his home in Florida. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, Owen. So for more, we turn to Lisa Miller, Senior Vice President at Rock Solutions and longtime Republican strategist. Lisa, never a dull moment. What do you make of these moves, especially the timing of them, only 101 days into Trump's second presidency?
Well, Tara, I don't think it's terribly surprising that this move is made. What I think is interesting here, Signalgate certainly was the catalyst for this change, no question about it, regardless of what the White House is saying. But I think the other thing that we need to take a close look at is this now puts Mike Waltz in front of the U.S. Senate to answer questions before he's confirmed to this post that he's been nominated to. And that, I think, is what's going to be especially interesting to watch. Certainly, Democrats are going to have a lot of questions about what happened there when he put Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic on that text stream or that signal stream. But what's also interesting is how Republicans in the Senate are going to respond to that as well. And so that, more than anything else, this change is not a surprise, I think, to anyone in Washington, D.C. But what will be a surprise is how people will react when he goes before the Senate for this new nomination. And that, I think, is what will really will capture headlines.
Which I was just going to ask you, how surprised you were going to be by that. So let's move on to this. For now, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will serve as National Security Advisor. I want you to listen to how Rubio's spokeswoman, Tammy Bruce, found out the news.
In addition to that, he says that in the interim, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will serve as National Security Advisor while continuing his strong leadership at the State Department. Do you know how long he's going to be serving in both roles?
It is clear that I just heard this from you.
All right. So what does that say to you about the decision?
Well, you know, I think, number one, it's a great vote of confidence for the Secretary of State that the president believes that he's doing a good job and he's going to serve well in this additional role. I think the Secretary of State has been empowered with more and more responsibilities because he is a tremendously capable former U.S. senator, former leader in Florida to take on this position. But they're moving very fast. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this seems to be sort of the standard bear for the way the Trump administration moves, is that they move quickly and sometimes they forget to let the spokespeople know what's happening before it happens.
Exactly. So Secretary Rubio is also the acting administrator for USAID and acting archivist of the U.S. So now he will be acting national security advisor, as we've said. So how unusual is this for a cabinet member to wear so many hats?
Well, it's not tremendously unusual in the first 100 days for more than one job to be served by someone that's already been confirmed by the Senate. But certainly, you know, this is not sustainable. These are tremendously important jobs, jobs that have got to be served well by individual heads. So it'll be interesting to see how it is this unfolds for the president. I suspect that the administration is already looking at a new candidate to step into the National Security Advisor role and that a new announcement will be made within the next several days. But for now, if nothing else, it's a signal to the country and a signal to the globe that the administration hasn't lost sight of the importance of that role and that they've put the guy that they believe is the best man for the job in that position for the interim.
Interesting indeed. Lisa Miller, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Trump administration is calling for transgender youth to be treated with therapy as opposed to so-called gender-affirming care. Health and Human Services released a lengthy report questioning the standards of treatment for transgender youth. This follows an executive order from the president banning the federal government from supporting gender transitions for anyone under 19 years old. In a statement, NIH Director Dr. Jay Bhattacharya says in part, quote, "Our duty is to protect our nation's children, not expose them to unproven and irreversible medical interventions." U.S. Senator Josh Hawley is calling on the FDA to reinstate safety regulations on the chemical abortion drug mifepristone. This follows a study from the Ethics and Public Policy Center finding that more than 1 in 10 women who use mifepristone experience adverse symptoms such as sepsis and even hemorrhaging. The Biden administration previously allowed the drug to be shipped via email, or via mail, rather, without any medical supervision. Hawley says the health and safety of American women depends on restoring these critical safeguards to the drug. Well, when it comes to the economy, the Trump administration officials say Americans need to be patient and things will turn around once the tariffs take effect. Democrats say the latest numbers don't lie. This after the U.S. economy just had its worst quarter in 3 years. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with the latest. Eric.
Well, good evening. Numbers across the board are down, from the country's gross domestic product to the stock market to job layoffs. While President Trump blamed former President Joe Biden for the economy, Democrats tell me it's all on him.
I have CEOs of major corporations with thousands of Illinois employees who are calling me and don't know which way to turn. How can they plan for their business in any future when this president changes his mind overnight, from day to day? You know, this is no way to run an economy.
Republicans defend the president's actions, saying the move will pay off in the near future.
President Trump has talked about this for a long time. He said, we're going to bring jobs back into the United States. We're going to bring manufacturing back into the United States. And there may be some short-term disruption. He's been saying that for a long time. That's exactly what we're seeing here with these GDP numbers.
Some GOP members are already thinking of the 2026 midterm elections and claim the latest economic data is a warning, the result of President Trump's trade war, while other Republicans are confident Trump's trade policies will pay off.
There's always concerns politically when you're the party in power, because you're making decisions and you're doing hard things if you're doing what you were elected to do. So generally, that's a true statement. Look, I think at the end of the day that economic conditions are very important in every single election.
We're carrying out exactly what we told the people. You look at it, this waste, fraud, and abuse is unbelievable. You look at the price of fuel, you look at the price of groceries. That process in the first 100 days is already going in the right direction.
While the midterm elections are 18 months away, Democrats are confident that they can flip control of the U.S. House. Right now, they're targeting 4 seats in Pennsylvania and already running ads and pouring thousands of dollars into several races in New York. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
And up next on EWTN News Nightly, we all want it, the secret to longevity. And as the world's oldest nun passes away, hear what she credits for her long life. The White House is touting the signing of a long-awaited minerals deal between the U.S. and Ukraine. Essentially, it gives the Trump administration future shares of Kiev's natural resources if the U.S. allocates new money to support its war with Russia. Yet, the agreement does not include any specific security guarantees, which Ukraine had demanded as part of a larger peace deal. On Capitol Hill, Democrats are speaking out against President Trump's historic mineral rights deal with Ukraine, going so far as to say the administration is extorting a war-torn country in need.
I think this minerals deal is more symbolic than real. It offers no immediate benefit to Ukraine or to the United States, for that matter, because most of the minerals are in areas under Russia's control.
Trump administration officials and Ukrainian leaders are touting the deal, saying it's a launchpad for expansive bilateral economic cooperation and is a signal of America's long-term investment in a free Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia is blasting the deal, sarcastically praising the U.S. for making a deal with a nation that will soon, quote, disappear. So joining us now to discuss this more is John Sidelides, geopolitical strategist and principal at Trilogy Advisors, LLC. John, thank you so much for your time. Obviously, it was a long road to get here, to get the U.S. and Ukraine to even agree to this deal. What got this across the finish line?
Several important aspects, I think, Tara. First of all, certainly if we go back to the implosion of the Oval Office, President Trump made very clear to President Zelensky that he didn't have much leverage at that point, and he has some leverage now. The United States is a partner of Ukraine. They'll be mining not only for metals and minerals and rare earth elements, but also developing oil and gas that will be a competition to Russia in the years ahead, as well as the rare earth elements processing and refinement that will help the U.S. economy de-risk from China. So Ukraine wins, the U.S. wins, and Russia and China need to be very concerned, not just today, but especially in the years ahead.
Now, we mentioned there are not any security guarantees included with this deal. So will the U.S. respond if Russia becomes, say, more aggressive?
I think it all depends on what we mean by aggressive. I mean, there are no security guarantees in terms of American servicemen and women on the front lines, but that would be foolish on the part of the United States. That would only exacerbate the situation between the U.S. and Russia and probably bring out a direct war. What's important here is that American companies will be investing, American civilians will be all along those front lines there, and Russia really isn't looking to kill Americans or to expand the war against the U.S. or against NATO. But if there is a major crisis, say over Crimea, and there's a Ukrainian effort to try to win back Crimea, the Russians may not care if there are Americans on the front line. So right now, I think it only helps Ukraine to have more Americans near those World War I type trenches that divide the Russian occupied territory from Ukraine. But down the road, there could be other miscalculations by Ukraine or other countries that could endanger American lives.
So do you think that peace is further away? Do you think this helps at all? What do you think is the future here?
I actually think this will help bring the parties closer together to a ceasefire, at least. I think there's significant additional leverage that Trump is waging against Vladimir Putin. He's clearly expressed on Truth Social and in public statements his exasperation with Putin's refusal to come to the table, and the important language in this statement that the Trump administration, A, recognizes this not as a conflict, but as Russia's full-scale invasion, excluding anyone who supported Russia's war machine, quote unquote, from the reconstruction of Ukraine, and also providing for essentially in-kind sales of U.S. arms to Ukraine in terms of increasing the capital contribution by the U.S. in this 50-50 fund. So in every which way, this sets back, I think, Russian aims and objectives. And I think the message that Trump is sending is, Putin, come to the table sooner rather than later. The longer you wait, the less strength you'll have coming to that negotiating table.
All right, John, so many moving parts and so much at stake. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, tonight, a religious sister in Brazil died earlier today. It is major news because she was believed to be the oldest person in the world. Sister Ina Lucas was 116 years old. She died at her home of natural causes just weeks short of her 117th birthday. Sister Ina said the key to her longevity was her Catholic faith. She was a lifelong teacher and created two marching bands in her schools. Rest in peace. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tara Mergener. Good night and God bless.